You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Father Bob McGuire. Welcome to the Father Bob Show. So, Father Bob. Focus, Father Bob. So, for people who don't know Father Bob, this is going to be an introduction to Father Bob McGuire and his views and the things that he's passionate about and angry about and wants to see happen out there. Now, we won't get into sort of the Father Bob McGuire background, I think, because people can go and read that if they want to read it. We'll put it all up on the website. It's up on your blog.
Boring.
But I'm interested in your perspective on a couple of basics. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Christianity. For people who've just arrived here from Mars and have never heard of Christianity, how would you describe what Christianity means from your 40 years involved in the church?
As a Christian,
first of all, and then we'll talk about as a Catholic priest.
It's an ongoing thing. It's what do you call it? It's a work of art in progress. Even your Pope is saying now that the church is only a microsecond old. Maybe he's saying it from a false argument point of view, because people might say, hey, you've been here for 2,000 years and you've done no bloody good. He's saying, no, that's only 2,000 years is a speck of time. Now, maybe you see where did Christianity come from. I would have thought that the old story of God had worn thin up till more or less 2,000 years ago, and then another story or episode began. That's what I would say that Jesus of Nazareth, because I don't want to say the first story was no bloody good, because it was, but in fact it tended to go to pieces. The foundational story was sabotaged by persons or person unknown, and you end up with this Jesus of Nazareth character, who I don't think meant to start something new, but meant to develop what was already there, trash bits of it, and heighten other bits of it. But above all, simplify the damn thing, because it had become a religious and a ceremonial and a moralistic quagmire. So in the middle of all that, he was going all right, and then they grabbed him and killed him. And in the middle of all that, it is alleged that the singer of the song continues to do it. Now, I haven't got time or the energy to talk about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead or the apparition, nothing. All I know is the song still goes on, and that's what Christianity / Catholicism is all about. It's the continuation of the song that was launched by Jesus of Nazareth.
What's the theme of the song?
Love. Unconditional love, self-sacrificial love. Non-judgmental, self-sacrificial love. If I was shot dead now, that's enough. Go on and say, I believe in God the Father, because then you get the apparatchiks, you see, put that core business into what's called creedal form. So you end up with formulas, which are important, apparently, for tribal groups and for institutions to pass on to the next stage of the management or whatever. So we end up with a thing that says, I believe in God the Father, Almighty Creator of heaven and earth. The core business is teased out into some propositions. We got very rational all of a sudden, whereas early days we were very emotional, you know what I mean, Pentecostal. But we turned very irrational and very intellectual. Now, where we are today seems to be at a fork in the river, where after 2,000 years, which may well be a microsecond or a nanosecond in the religious evolutionary story, we seem to have reached a plateau of changed language, so that you've got religion now almost has to catch up with humanism. Whereas I think that the previous few thousand years, humanism was catching up with, with religion. I think. Now I think that we find that human beings have done very well as a bunch of people with their code of conduct and their spiritual roadmap. They seem to have done very well. If you look at incidences around the world on the news and all that, you'll say, oh, God, it's a terrible place. But overall, we seem to have evolved very well and be on the verge of the next stage of evolution, which I would suspect would be, how are we to live together? We'll solve that one and we'll maybe end up in heaven. I think that's how it happens. Once you find out how to live with one another, well, I think you push a button or something, and then they change the signs, you know. And they say, oh, I thought yesterday was hell, and today it's heaven. See what I mean?
No, I got no idea what you're talking about, but let's go back to the subject of unconditional love, because it doesn't really strike me that way, I have to say. Is it really unconditional love and non-judgmental?
In principle, it's unconditional.
But isn't
practice, not?
Well, and isn't Christianity and Catholicism on top of that very much about you have to do these things and be this kind of a person and fulfill certain sort of moral objectives in order to be accepted into heaven by God and by Jesus?
Heaven is here. I don't want none of that business of life after death yet. Heaven is here. See, that's what he said. The kingdom of heaven is among us. So let's work together and we will build the kingdom of heaven on earth. See? Other boys and girls have had other ideas. The authorities in particular said, what's he talking about, this clown? Because he knows we're on about life after death. The kingdom later, or when the Messiah comes and we start, and we're all going to be swept away into heaven. And a new Jerusalem, a new... Your Jesus was eminently down to earth, literally. See, and perfectly satisfied to be, stripped, as St. Paul says, of his divinity, because he knew that the final solution is to get mixed up with the human race. That's what God has to do. That's the safest place for God, is to be mixed up with the human race. But anyway, back to your, this is incoherent, back to your view that in fact Christianity / Catholicism have not done as well as could be expected if they conform to the founder's principles. So you don't know what I'm talking about either.
Okay, so you maintain then that the basis of Christianity, even though it may not be expressed that way, is one of unconditional love.
Yeah, otherwise you just end up like some other religion. With a caste system or a bloody clerical overlay or something, see? This is special. This is on special, in fact, that if you can get unconditional love and non-judgmental relationships going, well, you say, oh, my God, this is like heaven. See what I mean? Because we've never seen it. I've never seen it. Have I experienced it? Oh, I don't know that I've read about it, for God's sake, but mainly in, I suppose, in myths and in fairy stories and in the gurus, the Jesuses and the Buddhas and the Muhammads and, the prophets in the Old Testament, not even the Moses and all those. I mean, forget that. That's all politics. But when you got to go to the prophets, who start talking in this funny language, you wouldn't know what they were talking about. Nobody knew what they were talking about except the bloody penny dropped somehow, that these guys are criticising us and saying that we have to go and start again. See? Now, that's what I'm saying. Maybe 2005, we've reached a plateau where we should, in fact, circle the wagons, have a review of where we came from, what had we done to get here, and maybe we should saddle up again and strike out again on this adventure. But we'll have to do it together. And that, strangely enough, at this very time, not long after people had prophesied that tribalism was out, tribalism now appears to be back in. You see what I mean? They were talking globalism and thought that that was where we had arrived at, but then at that very moment, localism pops its ugly head up again, or its head, whether it's ugly or not, I don't know. So you see, we've got a problem here, because your Christianity is a universal faith, hope, and love. Universal, see? It's been hijacked by tribes before, so that you end up with European Catholicism, which was different from Irish Catholicism, which was different from English, you know, and all that. Now, what we need now, and we can't get rid of the ethnic, or the cultural, rather, flavours, but this core Christianity, someone's got to make their bloody mind up what it's all about, so that we don't go around killing Incas again, in the name of Jesus or the cross, and we don't go putting bloody shirts on bare-breasted women in Vanuatu. We don't do silly cosmetic things. See, I'm not interested in cosmetic Christianity. I'm only interested in hardcore Christianity. Because, well, I suppose my age means I haven't got time to hang around while you put the makeup on and take it off again. You know, I've seen it put on before and taken off many times. So, and so is the world looking for a simple solution. See, I think we're all... What's the word? We've uncovered the human race's ability to do good. Geldof and he's mucking around for the poor. Sachs, is it Sachs? The bloke who says the end of poverty and all that. I think it's Sachs. Yeah. All of those, yeah, isn't it? All those things. Even your World Bank, for God's sake, sounds as though they're kind of got a bleeding heart. Sounds that way. It did sound that way with, who was it? Wolfensohn, was it? Mm. Now I think they've got that American man, haven't they? The war man. So maybe it'll sound different. But you see, now that you've got secular, maybe conscience developing nicely, thank you very much. At the same time, you may have the hardening of religious denominational consciences. See, I don't know how that happened. The world seems to have woken up to itself and to some of the secrets that the religions have kept hidden from them for centuries. And they've done it on their own, which suits me as a Christian, because your Jesus was always saying the outsider or the stranger will in fact save you, because you insiders are going to buggery. Now, which didn't make him the popular, you know, the local popular bloke. But he kept telling them that you insiders are on the verge of extinction, because you've messed up the core business. You worry too much about the vestments that the high priest is wearing, the vessels that they're using in the... You're worried how many lambs have got to have their throats cut this Passover. All of that, he said, this is atrocious. My father, he said, using a language of his own. My father, he said, not at all interested in how many sacrifices. We're only interested in one thing, and that is, how's your heart? See? If you've got a good heart, you get a red tick. You see? But what you're going on with, he said, is so bloody awful, because it imposes burdens on ordinary Jews, ordinary people. They can't measure up. Therefore, it's a clerical impost. See? The Romans. No. He said, forget the Romans. The Romans are a sideshow here. It's you lot. All right? The religious heavies. Whether you're Pharisees or Sadducees or Herodian, whatever you are, he said, you've buggered this thing up. If you like, we can rejig it. We can, what do you call it?
Reboot.
Yeah, all that. We can do that together. But they wouldn't have that. See, even the mob was too frightened of something that had been an institution in their lives for so long, toxic as though it may be. It at least gave them something which was probably an alternative to their miserable lives, and that was nationalism. What's that?
This is a book that I read recently. It's called The Faith, A History of Christianity, by a chap called Brian Moynihan. Quite an interesting book, and quite a thick tome, as you can see there. What's that? It's like 700 pages or something there, of very, very tiny writing. And, you know, the thing that leaps out at the book, which starts, you know, pretty much right back at the beginning and goes through to present ages, is that Christianity's got a fairly tawdry history. I mean, there's fairly early on, from about the time they did a deal with Constantine in the early 4th century, they started killing everybody who disagreed with them and got armies behind them, and eventually, you know, for the next 1,500 years had popes and bishops who bought their way into power.
1,500? The worst was that in 500 years.
Yeah, which 500 years? When did it stop being tawdry?
Oh, that stopped when those Renaissance popes disappeared. Your Michelangelo's son and all that. Eventually they all petered out and you ended up with pious popes. They got piouser and piouser as the time went on, until in fact, not just piouser.
It was kind of 1870 around the reunification of Italy, where they were still fighting for all their temporal lands, weren't they?
Mickey Mouse in comparison to what they were up to in the Middle Ages. Mickey Mouse, you see, but I mean, if you call it, that's tawdry, yes, it's tawdry.
So where did it go wrong, is my question?
Well, I don't know. I mean, everybody seems to blame the agreement with Constantine. They seem to. I mean, God Almighty, we haven't got the breadth of mental powers to be able to, by hindsight, you know, we're not forensic theologians looking for the cold case to be reopened, but you would suspect that it was that alliance with the Roman Emperor that suited them, the Roman Imperial Government, to take on board some new bureaucrats. And they knew that the Christians, like the Jews, we all know that the Jews are highly talented people, and they've been underground for so long. We know the Chinese are highly talented and making money and doing business, and yet they're underground in some, like Indonesia and lots of other countries, where they can't really present themselves publicly because they'll be persecuted. And the same with the Christians, who have been persecuted 400, 300, whatever it is, years. Then Mr. Constantine says, I'll let you out of jail if you agree to be the public service. So they say, whether that was rightly or wrongly, it's understandable that they'd prefer to be working in the public service than to be in jail. They took the man's offer. And that's when we suspect that we became the slaves of the government, of the emperor. And it went on like that. They kept talking about the Holy Roman Empire into the 1900s. Mm. See what I mean? Mm. Now that looks like a long time, but as people keep saying, don't forget, 6 million BC is the beginning of the story. It's not. Why do you always start at 2,000 years ago? That's what one writer keeps saying. That's where you make your mistake, is in fact you're not thinking big enough. This story goes back. So we haven't done as badly as the history books, some history books, may suggest we have.
Christianity goes back to 6 billion BC?
Well, he'd say the whole story. It's not a story. Christianity's not the story. The story is the story of the human race's evolution to what your Jesus of Nazareth calls the kingdom. So that story's been on since the lights went on in Africa in 6 million, is it a million? Million BC. In fact, you go further and say it was six, whatever it is, billion or something. Back to the. If there is a beginning, maybe. I don't think there's a beginning or an end. As we keep saying, without beginning or end, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going to narrow it down to kind of a manageable size, and I don't think the story is manageable. That's where you get your denominations from, you get your flavour, your religious, you get your sects from, cults, all of that. Because people keep trying to grab the buddy story and put it back in the bottle. And it won't go in the bottle. You see what I mean? Unless you do damage to it, in which case you end up with one of the religions. I mean, the religions are main religions, what we call main religions, are obviously regionally based in their origins, aren't they? Yeah. Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Judaism, Islam, and the Christian thing, more or less, you say, those came out of the desert. 1, 2, and 3. The others come from the other side of town, mm-hmm. don't they? Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is evolution, isn't it? Anyway, be that as it may, that's too big. That'll drive me insane if I start talking about that. I can't even think about it, let alone talk about it. But all I know is, you see, if we narrow this story down to Jesus of Nazareth, which is only 2,000 years ago, no one argues these days about Jesus of Nazareth being a historical figure. Nobody argues about Jesus of Nazareth hardly at all.
Why is that?
Because they know that the Jesus of Nazareth thing is okay.
Is there
humanly speaking, it's okay. Once you start wanting to use your Platonic, what's his name, who did the bloody Thomas Aquinas, all that mental exercise on Jesus of Nazareth, well then, you squeeze all the colour out of Jesus of Nazareth, you end up with theology of Jesus of Nazareth, and that's the bloody trouble with the churches. The churches were starting to live on a diet of wafer thin encounters with Jesus of Nazareth. You only got Jesus of Nazareth in a book, or if you got him in
Josephus.
Yeah, or in a convent or in a monastery or something, but you're not in the marketplace. Now, that's once you've got Jesus out of the marketplace, you haven't got Jesus anywhere.
And now, on TPN, it's time for a break.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Oh, God.
I love the smell of
bacon
in the morning.
Mr. Anderson, my name is Neo.
When a man with a .45 meets a man with
what's
a rifle, dead the man with a pistol,
he's
dead man.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Are you gonna bark?
What the hell is this?
That's a silly message. It means Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes.
All right, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
The Movie Show on the Podcast Network. We watch them so you don't have to. www.thepodcastnetwork.com/movie.
So let me ask you this. This is something else that I question often. It's 2005. So 2,000 years later, a lot's happened. You know, we've learned a lot about the world and the universe in the last 2,000 years, and yet there are still people out there who I meet every day who have this thing they call faith that makes no sense to me whatsoever on a logical or rational level. Why do some people have faith and others don't?
Faith.
Why do some people have faith?
This story. It's because I haven't been everywhere, have I? But I mean, all I know is there is more faith around than I would have expected. That's faith. That's born with us. Now you're going to say, "How do you prove it?" I can't prove it. Hard wiring to believe, but it seems to me that there's more people around the traps who are. What's the word? What's that boy used that word the other day? Some mode. Standby. Mm-hmm. Now, strangely enough, that's what one of the characters say in the Acts of the Apostles written by St. Luke when an Ethiopian public servant is in a chariot and he's reading the Jewish Bible and he's saying, this is interesting. Then somebody says, what's it all about? He said, how the hell do I know what it's about until someone shows me? See, now this looks as though it's one of those key concepts of the New Testament. How can I know unless somebody shows me? In other words, this is interactive. See? It's not an intellectual only pursuit. It's interactive. It's got to involve lots of us together pursuing this, whatever it is, this, what we thought was unreachable being called God. We find that God is closer than you or I could possibly imagine, and that's what we discover. and that's faith. After a while, you don't have to exercise faith because it's like breathing. You've got it because you have you've experienced, probably, not you've learned, but you've experienced that we are the ones we've been waiting for. Now, when that dawns on you, whether you're in a prison cell or a hospital ward or in your own home or at work or on the football, whatever, if you've experienced that this is as good as it gets and we are the ones we've been waiting for, well, that's what your Jesus of Nazareth was supposed to activate. That hope that we have arrived already and we don't know it. Now, you see, the God thing is all of that mixed up together. It's a magic pudding, you see. It's not just one thing. This is what us Westerners are mad on, being rational. I think we have to be, what's the word, relational. That's why we don't know much about God in the West, because we're not relational enough. We're bloody too rational.
What do you mean by relational?
Relational, I mean it's got a lateral, what do you call that? Horizontal and vertical. We've got to find out our place in the world. And we've got to be more aware of our obligation to connect with our ancestors and also with our future. I mean, this sounds like bullshit, but I mean, it's I swear to God, it's what it's all about. Because I've seen most human disasters that have happened around here, South Melbourne, Port Melbourne, have been because of breakdown in relations. The absence of an adult from a young person's life, not just the absence of one adult, but the absence of all adults. So that's chaos all of a sudden. Then we get everything that ensues from chaos, which is bad thinking, bad feeling, bad health, bad everything. Everything goes bad because there's no relationships as the centerpiece of that person's life. Now, I think that's all your Jesus came here to say, listen, boys and girls, how about bloody, you know, starting with yourselves and with your closest? And so he ended up being part of a family. I don't know whether his mother was virgin, or I don't give a bugger whether she was or not, as long as in fact she somehow got safely into the world, that suits me. I don't care.
That's a good segue into talking to us about open family. Explain the idea behind open family, what it is and what it does.
5 years ago there were kids on the street, a lot of kids on the street, 10 years of age upwards to 15, 16, and we were horrified. Delinquents and people, I think that society called people delinquents in those days, but I mean they were rare. There was a few gangs and few teenage kids who didn't fit into mainstream society for various reasons. Then all of a sudden, when I got out of the army and I came to South Melbourne, someone alerted us to the presence on the street of kids who had no place to go at all. So I thought, that's a bit strange, because they should at least, where is your mother and father, I used to ask. And then out came the story that in fact the mother and father were the ones who'd kicked the kid out, or the father had, or the mother had, or the mother's lover, or the father's lover, or somebody. So the kid was the collateral damage. So we started Open Family as a kind of a compensation to kids who had been deprived of their entitlement to family. We said, well, this thing will be here forever, and well, as long as you don't take an active part in proliferating crime and corruption and evil, well, then you'll always be welcome in this family. And even if you do continue to take part in crime and corruption and evil, well, then through circumstances you can't control, well, then we may not be able to have you in the heart of the family. You'll be in the heart, the mind of the family, not the heart, because we want you to come in from the other side, from the, what do you call, the dark side. See? So that was that generation's pledge. And then a lot of them died, see, because they petered out through violence, lots of violence in the old days. They got mixed up with the drugs, the prostitution, the, receiving stolen goods, the pedophiles, the
die from receiving stolen goods?
Well, yeah, of course you can, because in fact, well, now if you take part in the stolen goods business, of course somebody catches up with you and puts an end to you. A lot of people were snuffed out. There's a thing over there with 40 who died in the 80s, and they don't even run to most of the kids who died in the 80s. When I say kids, by that time they were an extra 4 years, 7, 8 years on top of 22 years of age, under 20. But all of that, you see, the dark side. So open family became more, what shall I say, had to take a more business-like approach and a less romantic approach to this business of saving street kids, unfortunately and fortunately, because I suppose once again, even open family got to the plateau and consolidated its position, became well-known in Melbourne at least, and better known for a short period of time because of Simon Hammond and his crew that put controversial advertisements up to advertise Open Family as a hotshot movement, social activist movement, and they used the Roo Cull was a famous one. In Brazil, they are going around culling street kids. You see, in Australia just now, we are only culling kangaroos, but one of these days, we may infect ourselves. All hell broke loose. Everybody was talking bloody Roo Cull, and then it was banned, and then we got more advertisement out of the banning than we did out of the... And that happened two or three times. Once a year, I think, Simon Hammond and whatever his firm was called trotted out one of these controversial shock... Well, then was shock. You know, why do we send money overseas to the poor when, in fact... And the kid is seen waltzing Matildas on the... trombone or whatever it was, and there's a white kid putting black nugget on his face and saying, maybe if I turn black, well, then somebody will help me. Now, that was a bit... They all got hysterical again, and once again with his advertisement. But I like that, because there's no other way, see. This is long before, if you drink and drive, you're a bloody idiot, and long before the Grim Reaper and AIDS... And I thought it was a good, because you had to somehow or another, like in Louisiana now, people are saying now, oh, look at all the poor people. Where have they been? Well, the bloody poor people have been there all the time. But we've managed to, I don't know what it is, to institutionalise them to the extent that, in fact, they're manageable, so to speak, from our point of view, and they don't offend us because they're all receiving social welfare benefits, etc., etc. But the flood comes, and out they come in the open. That's when we get frightened. I was thinking today I should do it on Good Friday, see, because there's a French bloke who did it on Good Friday, but back in the 50s. Abbé Pierre and the rag pickers, they were called in Paris. He arranged for all the poor people in Paris to come out in the open and be seen. On Good Friday, he said, it's no good going to church and pretending with a crucifix that we're doing something worthwhile. Why don't you all come out in the open and we'll have an open crucifixion? You know, they'll see you and they'll say, who the hell are these people? Where have they been? And the answer will be, darling, they're with you all the time, but you just don't see them. Same as beggars in Melbourne, same as, you know, we don't want to see them because once we see them, we'll have to answer a question. How did these people get to this predicament? And as Geldof says, whatever you think about these people, you must learn to respect their condition. See? You mightn't like them, you mightn't like the behaviour, you might not... You can't apply the same... dismissal... to their condition, because that is something that is inexplicable in a modern nation state. But see, as long as we keep them out of sight, that's why Open Family, I'd like to equip the street workers with, what do you call those things, camera phones, so they can nick around and they'll send us back direct reports from the street. So if there's a kid of 11 or whatever, they must let the bloody public see the kid of 11. They're not going to see it on Channel 7, 9. But you see, that's the beauty of podcasting and of, direct transfer of information to the public without the third party coming in and sanitising it. The only way to do it would be with this, and I've got 35 street workers at present. I want to have 135.
These are all the big red dots. Tell people about the red dots on your big map.
Map there, and I've got red dots all over. Then there are only some red dots, because we're lurking around in Sydney and Canberra and Melbourne with street workers. A street worker is what somebody defined once as a nomadic referral file. What a terrible term. But it means they're moving around everywhere, they're on their own, they learned the skill of referring people to whatever resources there are in the living off the land, to call the public servant officers as the land, knowing where to get help and all that stuff. So travel light, don't build an accommodation centre, none of that. Be a nomadic referral file, meaning it's all in this street worker's kit, and he/she becomes somebody who makes a hell of a difference on the street, because nobody has to beg him/her. Open Families philosophy has put this person at the so-called client's disposal, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I wanted that all over the sea. I think if you get on the streets, you see, you'll be able to mix it with Muslims, you'll be able to mix it with all kinds of people, not just street people anymore, but street workers should be a part of a natural environment in a sophisticated metropolis. There are a lot of people out there not finding it easy to negotiate being in a big city. And the social contract should extend to everybody, see? And people who are doing it hard out there should be cared for, and the only people they would trust would be somebody who's out there with them, and that person I can't find any other definition except street worker. And almost it should be street worker without borders. Unlimited, the doctors without borders. This should be street workers without borders. In other words, we need to go where we see the need. Not we go where the government department says we can go or something. Doctors Without Borders offended conventional Red Cross relationship type work because they went where they knew somebody needed the doctor. Not where they were. Politically, it was helpful to some government to have them go. So they then had to become self-funding. That's what I'm afraid Open Family will have to do, you see. In other words, instead of getting half our funding from the government, we should be getting most of our funding from our own resources, whether it's public donations or whether it's a business run by Open Family to produce funds specifically to spend on this work. Because we've got to get right around Australia before the ice cream hits the fan and you end up with alienated teenagers drifting away from, if not led by some clown, away from the dead heart of Australian society, which at the present moment is only rewarding achievers.
So does somebody need to be a Christian or a Catholic to be one of your street workers?
No, Open Family was never meant to be a confessional movement. Open Family was set up because the church wouldn't, couldn't, shouldn't be involved in such demeaning, so to speak, work.
No one tells St. Francis that.
No, Frank of Assisi. But the Frank of Assisi, you see, was good in his time, but then the next generation of Franciscans had difficulties because they were immediately grabbed by the Roman central authority and turned into a religious order. They had a rule of life to follow, and it was almost over. That's sad. That's what the Romans know, that if something good, like a person who's died, if you want to stop the story doing any good for future generations, then you canonise them. Mm-hmm. See? And that's a brilliant technique, but it's very sad because it's a centralist controlling methodology, because otherwise you'd have the village would say, listen, this woman, this man has been a hero. And that'll suit us. Nah, the Romans said that might run off and become a threat to us, therefore we'll make him into a canonised saint. That's the end of it. Mm. A stained glass bloody window or something.
I could tell you about my trip to Assisi last year, but let's turn Open Family. So if somebody wants to become a street worker, one of your vision for 130 street workers. Yeah. What do they do? What's involved?
I've got the street worker office, the desk. It's part of Open Family. We've got a bloke who manages it, Mark Young, just now. And I keep saying to him, what happens if somebody, he says, well, they'll report to me and I, in fact, plug them into a training program. Because you need training, you see. This is not easy. A training program for one, or a training, if we wait, as we did once, run a publicity campaign and said, don't give clothes to the poor, give yourself. And you saw people jumping into clothing bins. And the idea was, it's all very good to feed, to clothe, to shelter, but what they need is a person. So you donate your services for 6 months or so. It's a pious idea that, in fact, you could fund volunteer street workers around Australia who could, as long as they're on the bloody street, they're already worth their weight in gold.
Is it a full-time gig for these people, or is it a part-time thing?
Now we've got 35 full-time people, but
how do people who want to get involved in it, people who have a full-time job but want to get out there and help,
well,
what do they do?
That's another model. That's what we'll have to work out, another model. Whether somebody can do, I think somebody can do it part-time. It's like saying these days whether you can have part-time priests and clergymen. The answer is yes. I'm sure of it. In fact, maybe that's what it was in the beginning. You know what I mean? We had a brilliant period in World War II in France when they had people called worker priests who were ordained priests, but they lived in public housing and they went to work in factories and things. And they didn't, they didn't have to reveal their clerical identity, you know, but they wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. But they did, in fact, reveal their specialness as public bleeding heart people as well as being workers. So you've got to combine the both. And it's the same with street workers. I'd like to see, we did have, I think the original street workers were volunteers. Mm. They didn't get paid. And then after 6 months or a year, some of them said, oh, my girlfriend. And then we said, oh, well, we better give you a few quid. And then one thing led to another, my girlfriend or my boyfriend. What? It says that we're spending too much time. Away we went. The end of, like, for Francis of Assisi. The original glow began to fade, but then we did, in fact, end up with another type of street worker, and then, with thank God, with government funding, because the government was starting to say, let's become actively involved in trying to turn around the alcohol avalanche. So your drug and alcohol worker, so to speak, on the street became your street worker, who specialised in drug and alcohol interventions. Now, right now, we need to reprogram Open Families Training Office, which is probably a bit quiet because, in fact, we haven't, our marketing plan says we should be having the X number of workers. I said to Open Family Board, the incremental increase is too small. It's got to be exponential. What can we do? We'll have to design a hole. Now, they fell in a hole at the end of last year with that weighing them down because exponential frightened them. And I think that I'm going to have to kick ass.
So there's no model for part-timers at the moment, but it's something we could work on.
We've had a model before. It can be revived. Because we got an amazing number of applications before, and from around Australia, we'll have to start a new program for volunteers. If we became what the Salvos are saying they want, which is volunteers, volunteers need to be nurtured. Everybody needs to be nurtured. This is a hell of a job. Once you go out in the streets and you go in the dark and you get mixed up with the dark side, you can be easily like Darth Vader, be corrupted. See what I mean? And that's what happens because I've seen people corrupted. You know what I mean? Or show signs of being corrupted. And not looking for it, but it attracts. It's got an incredible capacity to find the cracks in the armour, the toxins, And then that's a sad thing, because you have people, you know, who are good people who've gone off, like a bottle of stale milk, you know, start dealing in drugs, or they become codependent with their client, so to speak, and turn into their client. You see, you don't want the bloody client turning into the street worker either. You know, I mean, metamorphosis. But the other words, the other way it can go too, where the street worker metamorphosizes, whatever it is, into the street kid. See? Dangerous, dangerous. That's why the team, we need the team, and we need experienced workers. Hate to leave experienced workers. Got a few experienced workers, but a bit like the Australian 11. See, when do they get too old to be effective? See?
Is that a cricketing analogy? I don't follow the cricket.
Don't you? Yeah, that's cricketing, because we lost the Ashes back to the British, and they're saying that we're too old, and the Brits were young. Now, it might be the same that with this business of open family, where the old workers who become very knowledgeable, they may well have to assume positions in the training unit. You see, I know what I'd do. I'd have a training unit, and I'd have a training program, and I'd be going out announcing publicly to the Australian community, come and join us, or even we should be able to do it by whatever that is, IT.
The internet.
Yes, we should be able to train people virtually.
Let me wrap up by asking you a question. Have you heard about flying spaghetti monsterism?
No. What is it?
I just heard about this today. It's a new religion that was started by a guy in the US in a response to the Kansas Board of Education when they decided that they were going to start teaching intelligent design alongside evolution. He invented a religion called flying spaghetti monsterism that says that the world was created by a flying spaghetti monster, and he wants them to teach that alongside intelligent design in the schools. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think all of those things should be aired. Maybe in the UFO department, you know, unidentified flying object department, where you'd have God and you'd have the, what is this thing?
Flying spaghetti monsters.
And then the other one is intelligent design. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that. No, anyway.
Thank you, Father Bob.
What do you think of that, Frank? Frank, spaghetti, flying spaghetti monster.
Frank's Father Bob's big black
dog.
What kind of dog is it, Father Bob?
Standard poodle.
It's a big bloody poodle.
Well, this is not as big as the last one. The last one lived to be 20 years of old age. Slightly longer legs. Frank, what do you think?
The Podcast Network. Real power can't be given. It must be taken.